Chapter 14. South's Greatest Legal Battle.
In anticipation of the great legal battle to come, a crowd began to collect in front of the courthouse shortly after daylight on the morning of Monday, July 28th. At 8 o'clock, an hour before time set for the opening of court, the intersection of Hunter and Pryor Streets was black with people. It was with the greatest difficulty that a squad of police, abetted with a corps of deputy sheriffs, kept the thoroughfares open to traffic. Occasionally a car would grind up to the corner and stop, while the human mass grudgingly opened and let it by. Hundreds surged through the entrance of the red building and up the single short flight of stairs to the door of the room in which the trial was to be held. Inside, a dozen electric fans and a number of ozonators had been installed to keep the air pure and the atmosphere as cool as possible through the long, hot days to come. Benches had replaced the chairs, and the seating capacity had been increased to 250. Only talesmen, attorneys, newspaper men, intimate friends of the prisoner, and a few spectators were admitted. The witnesses summoned by the state, who numbered over 100, were assigned to a courtroom on the second floor to wait until they were called to testify. Among them were scores of factory girls, heads of departments, policemen, and others who had knowledge of some phase of the case. Frank was brought from his cell in the Fulton County Jail shortly before 7 o'clock. He was met by his mother, Mrs. Ray Frank, and his wife, upon his arrival, and spent the intervening hours until court convened chatting with them and other relatives. He appeared glad that his long wait in jail was at an end. He remarked that he expected an acquittal. He was led into the courtroom shortly before 9 o'clock and chose a seat directly in front of the judge's rostrum. His mother and his wife were seated on either side of him. A few minutes later, attorney Luther Z. Rosser, Reuben R. Arnold, and Herbert Haas arrived. They were followed by a dozen assistants carrying documents and books of law. Solicitor General Hugh M. Dorsey, his special assistant Frank A. Hooper, and Assistant Solicitor A. E. Stevens were the last of the lawyers to appear. Immediately upon his arrival, Mr. Arnold, on behalf of the defense, announced that he was ready to proceed with the trial. Solicitor Dorsey stood ready to vigorously oppose a motion for a delay. Promptly at 9 o'clock, Judge L. S. Roan mounted the bench. Sheriff Mangum and Chief Deputy Plenty Minor rapped for order, and the hubbub in the audience ceased. A hush fell over the room. The famous trial had begun. The clerk of court began calling the names of the veneer men. This completed, 8 panels of 12 each were organized from the 144 talesmen summoned. One at a time, the various squads marched into the jury box for the purpose of presenting excuses if they had any to offer. Several were dismissed by the court on various grounds. After this formality, Judge Roan instructed Solicitor Dorsey to call the names of the witnesses. They were brought down from their room upstairs and responded to roll call. Only the names of 26 of the actual material state witnesses were called. Solicitor Dorsey announced that he had summoned many others, whose names he would announce later. He then called these: J. W. Coleman, stepfather of the murdered girl; Mrs. J. W. Coleman, the mother of Mary Fagan; George W. Epps, a newsboy; Police Sergeant L. S. Dobbs; City Detective L. S. Starnes; W. W. Rogers, a court bailiff; City Detective John Black; Miss Grace Hicks; L. M. Gant; Pinkerton Detective Harry Scott; City Detective B. B. Hazlitt; E. F. Holloway; M. B. Darley; William A. Giesling; Dr. Claude Smith, city bacteriologist; Dr. J. W. Hart, coroner's physician; Dr. H. F. Harris, president of the State Board of Health; E. L. Perry, E. S. Smith, Miss Bonteen Stover, Albert McKnight, colored, Manola McKnight, colored, Miss Helen Ferguson, Mrs. Arthur White, L. Stanford. Three of the list did not appear. One was Detective Hazlitt, who was announced to appear later. Another was Albert McKnight, Negro, husband of Manola McKnight, who was cook at the Selig and Frank home. An attachment was issued for the Negro. L. Stanford, the third witness who did not answer, it was stated, has received a subpoena to appear in court Tuesday. The name of James Conley, confessed accomplice to the hiding of the body, was not called. Solicitor Dorsey announced, however, that he had not abandoned his intention of calling him to the stand. At the instruction of Judge Roan, the defense then called the names of the following witnesses, all of whom responded. F. Sagidley, Annie Hickson, Mrs. Levy, Mrs. Josephine Selig, Emil Selig, H. J. Hensey, R. H. Haas, W. H. Mincy, who did not answer, J. T. Spear, E. F. Skipper, who did not answer, E. L. Santel, May Barrett, C. H. Carson, Mrs. Rebecca Carson, Harry Denham, Harry Gottheimer, Miss Corinthia Hall, Miss Hattie Hall, Mary Burke, Lemmy Quinn, Herbert J. Schiff, Ella Thomas, C. B. Gilbert, Frank Payne, Eula Flowers, Alonzo Mann, Joseph Stegar, Ike Strauss, J. C. Loeb, L. J. Cohen, Emma Bibb, Mrs. Bessie White, Joe Williams, Wade Campbell, William McKinley, J. E. Lyons, Dora Lavender, M. O. Nix, Jerome Michael, Mrs. M. J. Michael, George W. Parrott, Mrs. M. W. Meyer, Rabbi Marks, William Taylor, Mrs. Beatrice Taylor, Fred Weller, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Eisenbach, Carl Wolfsheimer, Ed Montag, J. Fleming, T.T. Brandt, Flossie Shields, Dora Small, Mrs. R. Freeman, Charles Leek, Mrs. Ike Strauss, Mrs. T.J. Cohen, Milton H. Cleveland, Julia Fuss, Walter Pride, J.C. Matthews, W.B. Bowen, M.W. Meyer, A.E. Meyer, A.E. Marcus and Mrs. Marcus, A.E. Haas, Ike Haas, Leonard Haas, Leopold Haas, William Montag, Ike Hirschberg, A.B. Levy, Bert Kaufmann, Robert Schwab, Otto Schwab, William Rosenfeld, Sidney Levy, Louis Elsass, J.C. Gershon, George Gershon, Walter Rich, B. Will Dower, Sidney Levy, Saul Samuels, and Arthur Heyman. At 10:40 a.m., the first panel was called into court for examination. The 12 men took their seats in the jury box, and Solicitor Dorsey asked the usual formal questions of each. Are you or your wives related by blood or marriage to the defendant, deceased, or prosecutor? Have you, from having seen the crime committed or having heard any of the testimony delivered on oath, formed or expressed any opinion as to guilt or innocence of the prisoner at the bar? Have you any prejudice or bias resting on your mind, either for or against the defendant? Is your mind perfectly impartial as between the state and the accused? Are you conscientiously opposed to capital punishment? As each veneer man qualified under those questions, the solicitor would proceed with the usual legal formula, announcing competent and directing, juror, look on prisoner, prisoner, look on juror. Each member of the first panel was excused for cause or by peremptory challenges. The second and third panels were more fruitful, however, each netting four jurors. A. H. Hensley had the distinction of being the first peer chosen. He was passed by both sides at 11:40 a.m. At 1:15 p.m., 11 jurors had been selected from the various squads of talesmen that were examined in quick succession. The rapidity with which the box had been filled surprised everyone. As one after another, the members of the eight and last panel expressed bias and prejudice, or declared that they already had a fixed opinion, it was feared, however, that it would be necessary to summon another veneer of talesmen before the jury would be committed. The last man called, C.J. Bosshart, was accepted. He was the 144th talesman, and had he been disqualified, it would have delayed the trial several hours. The 12 men selected to decide Frank's fate were M. Joe Henning, W. S. Woodward, J. T. Osborne, A. H. Hensley, F. V. L. Smith, J. T. Higdon, Dieter Townsend, W. S. Metcalf, F. E. Winburn, A. L. Wisby, Charles J. Bosshart, and W. M. Jeffries. All except Bosshart were married. At 1:30 p.m., Judge Roan ordered a recess until 3 o'clock. Frank ate the first of a series of dinners in the antechamber in the rear of the courtroom. With him were his wife and mother and friends. At noon he seemed cheerful and declared that he was glad the tedious work of getting a jury was over. The jury, which had lunched in a downtown restaurant, was returned to the courtroom at 3 o'clock, and 5 minutes later, Mrs. J. W. Coleman, mother of the slain girl, was called to the stand. She was the first of the scores of witnesses who testified at the trial. As she stepped upon the platform and seated herself in the witness chair, a hush fell upon the courtroom. It was the first of many dramatic scenes of the trial. She was clothed in deep black. Talking slowly, and in a voice that could scarcely be heard beyond the jury box, Mrs. Coleman, in answer to questions put by the solicitor, told of last seeing her little daughter. Mary had helped her with the housework on the morning of Saturday, April 26, she said, and after partaking of a meal of cabbage and biscuits, had left home at 11:50 a.m., with the intention of going to the pencil factory to draw the $1.20 due her for 2 days' work. At the time, little significance was attached to the testimony relating to the food the girl had partaken of. Later, this point formed one of the most vital issues of the whole case, because the contents of the stomach of the girl were used by the state to prove that she had been murdered within an hour after eating. Mrs. Coleman broke down on the stand and sobbed when called upon to identify clothes worn by her daughter. She regained her composure to such an extent that she was able to answer a few immaterial questions asked by defense lawyers, however. George Epps, a playmate of the victim of the murder, and one of the last people to see her alive, was the second witness called by the state in forging its chain of evidence. He told of riding to Forsyth and Marietta Streets with the little girl, and leaving her 5 minutes before she entered the pencil factory. It was agreed between them that they were to meet at 2 o'clock to view the Memorial Day parade. She did not keep the appointment, the lad testified. Old Newt Lee followed the boy to the stand. For 2 hours, Monday afternoon, he withstood the grilling of Luther Z. Rosser, at no time becoming confused or perturbed. And when court convened again Tuesday morning, he remained in the witness chair, under the merciless fire of questions, for 3 hours. He left the stand, his story unshaken. In quaint Negro dialect, he described the finding of the body, told of calling the police, of meeting Frank rubbing his hands in the pencil factory on the afternoon of the murder. He was taken over and over his story several times, but avoided every trap laid for him by the shrewd cross-examiner of the defense. "All I want is chewbacca, any kind," was his request when he was led out of the courtroom. His comment on Luther Rosser was, "He's pretty terrible. He sort of wants you to say things just his way,
but I was dared to tell the truth, and I told it."
At adjournment Tuesday, the state had laid the foundation for its case against the young factory superintendent. They had proved that Mary Fagan left home at 11:50 a.m. and introduced witnesses to show that she arrived at Forsyth and Marietta Streets at 12:07 p.m., or a few minutes before that time. They introduced witnesses to show that she went toward the pencil factory, and that she probably never left the building, inasmuch as she never returned home and failed to keep later appointments. Several of the policemen who answered the first call of Newt Lee and went to the pencil factory, and others who knew of the first steps in the investigation of the officials, were called and told of the finding, the position, and appearance of the body when they viewed it and the surroundings. During the forepart of the trial, Leo M. Frank's expression of quiet confidence surprised everyone that saw him. He sat between his wife and his mother, both of whose faces were passive and emotionless for the most part, with his arms crossed and his gaze centered on the jury, the witness stand, or one of the attorneys. He spoke little. His manner was not that of indifference. Apparently he analyzed every piece of testimony entered against him, and he seemed to comprehend all the legal questions that arose. Nerves, apparently, were not in his makeup. He was calm, cool, and appeared sure of himself and his cause. He displayed no more anxiety than any of the spectators. As he sat a few feet from the judge's stand at the left of his attorneys, friends and relatives clustered behind him, he seemed the smallest man in the long, wide room. The jurymen in the box almost towered above him. He could just see the judge over the top of the rostrum. He was attired in a blue mohair suit and wore nose glasses, which he wiped on his handkerchief occasionally. He was almost boyish in appearance, but his bearing had a firmness and determination which proved his years. Never once during the long days to come did he exhibit any more feeling than on the first 2 days of the trial. His manner was the same in victory as in defeat. The spectators might complain of the heat, the lawyers of long hours and hard work, the baileys of difficulty in handling the crowds that stormed the courtroom. But Frank was the same every day and every hour of the day. He passed the time of day with a few of the newspaper men with whom he had come in contact in the first few days following his arrest, before he entered into his 3 months' silence in the tower. Further than that, he would not go with reporters, and his wish was respected. Every morning in the jail, he was up at 7 o'clock, took a bath, and less than half an hour later accompanied Sheriff Mangum to the courthouse. He was known as the most obedient prisoner in the jail. So great was the confidence of the county officers in him that he never was handcuffed on the rides from jail to court and court to jail. He was permitted unusual freedom about the courtroom, and never once did he violate an admonition of a guardian. Sheriff Mangum said of him, "He is the best prisoner I ever had. He does everything I tell him." He ate his breakfast, in fact all of his meals with the exception of dinner in the evening, in an anteroom. In the mornings and at noons he always entertained from half a dozen to a score of friends. Among them were many of the prominent men of the city. The manner in which his acquaintances clung to him through his many hours of need was one of the features of the whole case, and all believed in his innocence. His employers, the men he worked with in the factory, scores of women subordinates, all hotly proclaimed that he was a victim of circumstances and did not have the blood of Mary Fagan on his hands. Even the charge of moral perversion which was brought against him during the trial did not shake this confidence. Witnesses who accused him of improper relations with women employees of the factory were termed perjurers, and women who late in the trial testified that he was not of good character were described by one of the accused man's friends as fanatics.